New Committee on Health of the National Assembly. Before we continue, I am in a bit of a position where we have load shedding in my town. I have driven to another town this morning to be able to continue with this meeting. So I'm not going to switch my camera on. Be mindful that I had seen the parliamentary streaming unit is also on the meeting platform. So those who are able to please switch on your cameras when you do speak. Before I go ahead and welcome our the CGE, I would first need to make certain that we get our attendance and apologies from Ms. Majalamba.
Morning and thank you, Chair. Present is Dr. Jacobs, Ms. Gela, Mr. Sokacha, Dr. Harvard, Ms. Clark, Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ishmael, Dr. Tembe Kwayo, Ms. Chirwa, and Ms. Stefan Stalin. I've received an apology from Ms. Lengwa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We also need to hear who is on our meeting from the Ministry, our PLO, and from the Department, our PLO. Mr. Joe Khatla can just indicate to us.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Thank you very much, the Chair. This morning, it will be joined by Dr. Manala Makua, who's the Director on Maternal and Women's Issues. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khatla. We will also be joined this morning by the Commission for Gender Equality. We will be doing the following presentation. We would all remember that we had two presentations from them last week. This is the third. I think there are four that they had requested. I'm not certain I can be corrected, but today's presentation will be the investigation into the choice of termination of pregnancy in South Africa. And before we proceed, honorable members, I need to remind you that this virtual meeting is deemed to be in the precinct of Parliament and therefore constitutes a meeting of a committee of the National Assembly for official purposes only. In addition to the rules of virtual sittings, the rules of the National Assembly, including the rules of debate, apply. Members enjoy the same powers and privileges that apply in a sitting of the National Assembly. Members should equally note that anything said in the virtual platform is deemed to have been said to the House and may be ruled upon. All members who have logged in shall be considered to be present and are requested to mute their microphones and only unmute when recognized to speak. This is because the microphones are very sensitive and will pick up noise which might disturb the attention of other members. When recognized to speak, please unmute your microphone and connect your video. Members may make use of the icons on the bar at the bottom of their screens, which has an option that allows a member to put up his or her hand to raise points of order. The Secretariat will assist in alerting the chairperson to members requesting to speak. When using the virtual system, members are urged to refrain or desist from unnecessary points of order or interjections. I've already indicated the presentations which we will be receiving and the interaction we will be having today. I have asked Honorable Sokacha to assist me in case I do get cut off with this meeting to continue chairing this meeting. I'm going to make every endeavor to just move to another spot where there's maybe a better reception. We would have to then see how this meeting proceeds. And then let's also not forget that after this presentation, we will be having some minutes. I think it's about three or four sets of minutes, which we would have to consider and adopt. And that would be what we'll be doing today. Ms. Jamela Robertson, I see you have already been made a co-host. I'm going to welcome you and your team again. Thank you very much for coming to do your presentations. You may introduce your team and yourself and also then continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning and good morning to honorable members and colleagues. I was looking in the on the list. I didn't see my member, my commissioners. I do know that we have another presentation to another portfolio committee this morning. So we've been splitting up and some of them are doing field work. So we try to attend as best as possible where we can. But I will be just quickly show my face. I will be doing the presentation. I will now switch off my camera, Honorable Chair, and project the presentation. Thank you. May I check if it's projecting, Honorable Chair?
It is. Thank you very much. Very clear. Please continue.
Thank you, Honorable Members, Honorable Chair. The presentation is one of our latest investigations conducted in 2020-21. So this is one of the reports that were tabled in March 2021. In terms of the introductions, Honorable Chair, I will not dwell on the mandate as it's something that is just a preliminary information by way of introducing ourselves as a Chapter 9 institution and also with regard to the legal framework that we are operationalizing in doing the work of the Commission. And I just put a few national and international instruments that we are operationalizing as we do this work. What I will talk
a little bit... Just a moment, I forgot to say something else to you. I noticed you had 96 slides, and then I requested for you to decrease it because last week we were quite lenient on the time, but unfortunately we also have sittings and other things, other work we've been doing. So I'm going to give you 45 minutes to present, and then we will take 45 minutes for questions and answers. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The presentation I'm projecting has about 21 slides. I had gotten the message to reduce the presentation, so I tried to shorten it from those 96 to about 21 slides. So I will take much less than 45 minutes to present. Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, on the introduction, I have tried to just move quickly with other legislation that inform our work, but I want to talk a little bit about the specific legislation pertaining to this current investigation that we have conducted as the Commission. Just to note that this act enacted in 1996 and amended in 2008 is deemed one of the most progressive legislation in South Africa as it relates to women's sexual and reproductive health and rights. And this is because in South Africa, we had recognized that millions of lives were lost through what we back in the day called backstreet abortion. So in recognition of that, this law, it's one of the motivations to try and have terminations of pregnancies available in the public service, specifically in the health sector, to reduce the deaths, the unnecessary deaths of women in backstreet terminations. However, much as we have seen improvements to date, in terms of reducing these deaths. We find that there is still a significant number of women who actually are still dying in informal terminations that are done outside of the health system. But suffice to also indicate that since the introduction of the surgical terminations, we have seen all throughout democracy, we have seen the reduction by over 90%, which is a significant milestone. But death of any kind, even if it's one, it's not acceptable if it can be prevented. Hence, we still push for access in the public service as it pertains to this situation in South Africa. Just a quick glimpse into the methodology, just to set context on the findings. This investigation was conducted on the onset of COVID in 2020. So rather than interviewing people in person, we had to send a questionnaire, and we sent a questionnaire to the National Department of Health and also provincial departments of health, seeking information pertaining to the variables that are listed here, from issues of the number of institutions providing terminations, issues of access, the funding model, the referral system, and so forth, including our own findings at the bottom. So the limitations basically was that we conducted this pretty much virtually, although where information was not available through the questionnaire, we were able to call and try to fill the gaps as much as possible. So the way I tried to reduce the slides, Honorable Chair, was to try and summarize the information across the themes that I have listed in the methodology, and where possible, separate all the institution. But as we continue, we'll see that we have put the National Department separately, because the information we got from the National Department was sometimes verified through provincial information. So I have split the information in that manner. Also, because provincially we tended to find common themes across, so hence we could put the information together and highlight where experiences in this regard are common in the provinces. So in terms of the institutions providing terminations, where we got information, we have provided them there. From the department, we got 350. But when you go provincially, you get numbers that don't add up to 350. I think in some cases, provinces have included private institutions. If we look at Mpumalanga, for instance, so when you go to provinces, you find more numbers than estimated from the department. So that is the reason why the numbers don't add up to 350. I thought I should just mention that at this stage. When we asked a question around the issue of accessibility to the services, the department obviously has its guidelines that requires that facilities display the services and also implement the services in terms of the law, which allows for medical abortions from 9 weeks, and then you go to 12 weeks, and under special circumstances, 20 weeks. And the circumstances may include perhaps the health of the woman, or the you know, issues of health and other conditions that may be affecting the woman carrying the pregnancy to term and giving birth. Some of the here I've listed information in terms of provinces, because you found that provinces like the Western Cape, which is common in different studies, you find that you have better services, you have better accessibility, you have better a situation in terms of the equipment or the resourcing of the facilities. So they would report minimal unsafe terminations and late requests. So they didn't experience this a lot, because when we look at the full report, we will see the numbers that they have, as indicated as well in the previous slide. So the issues of accessibility are not necessarily a big issue, although they do exist in smaller towns that can't reach facilities. In the Free State, some of the issues we found were that there were issues of challenges for women from towns that are far from the city, like Bloemfontein, for instance. So you have those remote areas where women continue to experience a lack of access to services. And again, I usually say here that you find that it's rural Black women who tend to be disadvantaged when it comes to access. And as this democratic system, those are some of the issues that we're trying to redress. But in the Northwest, when we asked the question of accessibility, they spoke about, you know, the staff, the equipment and drugs. So but there were issues of distances that were also mentioned in the Northwest. But what we picked up as the commission was that if you look at the province, the 26 facilities that provide the services are not enough, especially because the province is also vastly rural, if you like. So you still have those issues where the poor continue to be marginal in terms of accessibility to services. In Gauteng, again, what you would get is, when we talk about access, emphasis was put on issues of compliance with the Act and the guidelines that have been provided by the National Department. And I think honorable members will remember when I presented last week the issues of guidelines and you know, the acts or the laws that we are implementing. I know we weren't all agreeing on this, but the point that we are making as a commission is assuming that service providers are able to follow the guidelines to the T and be able to say the law requires us to do this. Sometimes we find that gap exists, and we need to keep reorientating our service providers around these issues. And this is not to say they don't understand the law. It's one thing understanding it, and it's another doing. In the Eastern Cape, this is one of the most disadvantaged provinces, because again, is the issue of the vastness and the remoteness of areas in this province that pose as a barrier to access, as well as the issues of subjective beliefs cuts across. This is an area where people have different ideas or beliefs in terms of how things should be happening. But obviously, as an entity, we keep reminding service providers that why this act came into being in the country and what we're trying to resolve, and how this act, when it was amended in 2008, it was trying to incorporate, amongst other things, the issue of taking a human rights-based approach in providing these services, as well as increasing the number of facilities in provinces. In KZN, it was reported that the facilities that are there were adequately equipped, and there also were issues where some facilities provided 24-hour services, which was a good thing. And there were also reports that they are working on increasing the number of facilities in the province, because again, KZN is also a vastly rural to a certain extent. So they did acknowledge that you still have that cross-cutting situation where women in remote areas are having difficulty accessing their services. In Mpumalanga, again, the issue of access was referred to in terms of trained staff, as indicated in the previous slide, equipment and drugs, and also the ability to refer complications. So although in the main report you can see that the issues of distances, again similarly with Limpopo, so these provinces that have are mainly rural, you will always find the issue of distances. In Limpopo, one of the things that we have picked up was the number of facilities, again, given the population of the province, didn't seem to be sufficient in our judgment as we were analyzing this information. In terms of the funding model, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, you find that the department obviously use the equitable share formula, but as the commission, when we conduct these investigations, when we are told we are using this particular guideline or formula or whatever, we are interested in seeing the how part of it. But when we don't get the how part of it, we're not able to see whether the allocation of resources are indeed equitable, because equitable is different from equal. So we can't allocate resources equally across provinces when provinces have differences. This may be there, but at the time of the study, we were not able to find the actual allocation so that we can be able to comment on how equitable the allocation of resources is. And as you will see, Honorable Members, the thematic areas across provinces again relates to the issue of the equitable shares, as indicated by the department. But again, it's the same situation where we couldn't see how these resources are allocated to this particular service. And one, generally, you throughout the provinces, you find that the budget for this service is lumped with budget for maternal health services, whether it's a reproductive health a department in a province or nationally. It comes in one package, and one can comment through other research that this happens with most of the services. Cervical cancer is one of those. So you find that we allocate a budget in a lump sum. So it's difficult to assess whether the budget is based on the needs of a particular service in a particular province. So that's basically what it is. I mean, there will be variations where some would say, like the Northern Cape, they are funded through the district health services budget. Others, just have what I have just said about the vote, which is part of what is explained in the equitable share when we look at the details of the report. In terms of the referral system, Again, the department provides guidelines where the facilities have a referral pathway, which clearly indicates facilities that are providing the service, and also how the clients are referred in particular periods where the services are provided. And however, the implementation is a challenge. And I think this is a common thread throughout, that sometimes while we have good laws, as we always say, good guidelines, good policies, a good system, if you look at the setup of our system in South Africa, health systems and other sectors that we look at, you find that the setup is brilliant, but implementation, it's something else. So when you look at the guideline, you find that they are good, but implementation, an example we are giving here, it's a woman who came to the commission to complain that she has been turned away from Shawelo Clinic during lockdown. And the reason for turning her away were that we only provide emergency services. And the CGE had to intervene, and the woman was eventually assisted. So this is just one of the examples where we may have good guidelines, but sometimes when you get to the facilities, you get individuals who are doing things in a way that is not desirable. And again, when you look at the provincial findings, some like the Western Cape would, you know, as I've indicated, would provide information that indicates that they are sticking to the law, and they have various modes of referral as listed there. They also conduct what they refer to as triage, or fast checking those that needs urgent attention, maybe because they are at the last stages of their gestational period, maybe 12 weeks or 9 weeks when it comes to medical terminations. Often you find that PHC facilities, primary healthcare, would refer their clients to designated hospitals. Some had a booking system where priority was given to women who are in their late stages. Some provinces could not even indicate if they had any guidelines or standard operating procedures for managing referrals. So you had those variations, and the variations really is for us, when we assess the information that we had to do with, as people, how we treat these issues. And again, speaking to a situation where we interpret guidelines and laws in different ways. So the listed there are just some of the examples in terms of how provinces use the referral system. And obviously for patients up to 20 weeks, they are referred to professionals such as doctors and midwives who can perform such procedures, including referral using the local ambulance services. But in some places, you had a situation where people had their own transport and they can just be told where to go, so to speak. As when it comes to patient assessments, again, the department provided that general approach into what is in the guidelines. But when we looked at the backlogs, and especially when you go to provinces, you had to we have made recommendations in terms of how to deal with this situation of backlogs and so forth. The department was also aware of the backlog, and this was also verified in provinces. In terms of the provinces themselves, patients are assessed as listed there when they come for the service, first confirming if the pregnancy exists. And believe you me, Honorable Chair and members, sometimes it does happen that you think you are pregnant only to find it's symptoms of some other health issues. We have had experiences where pregnancies were not confirmed through the assessment. You have counseling, history taking, observations in terms of other health issues, the physical examination, and of course, the consent. And in some cases, the ultrasound. And clients with unconfirmed pregnancies or early pregnancy complications are referred to gynecological emergency services. Clients received family planning counseling and these honorable members is sometimes, I remember back in the years when we were conducting research where in South Africa, at least speaking to information that exists, you had situations where some clients would say, I can't use contraception because it affects my sexual life or different reasons. And some of the education that were provided was that terminations are not a means for prevention. We need to prevent before we get to terminations. So that's why the service in some instances, not in all provinces, when we look at the full report, we'll see that some provinces will provide that family planning counseling because it is very critical for our people to understand how this service should be provided as far as terminations are concerned. In terms of the promotion of the TOP services, and I hasten to explain when we talk about promotion, because questions have come before, why are you promoting this? This is promotion in terms of raising, you know, awareness in terms of the accessibility of services. So women don't end up in terminations, as we put it. So you promote access, you raise awareness around access and so forth. So the department at the time of this investigation submitted that it does conduct training for staff members who provide top services. They have a comprehensive training manual, and module 3 of that manual is is on the termination of pregnancies. In terms of the provinces, they also indicated that they advertise, and this was common throughout provinces, that they advertise at accredited facilities, and the advertising may range from having posters displayed in the facility. Some have they raise awareness in communities. They have pamphlets. They have community dialogues, and this is the kind of common work that even the commission does. As we have a public education department, so sometimes we do work with provincial health departments, sometimes the national department in terms of providing education to communities. And the housing department even indicated that they have this Mpilo app, which is a mobile communication platform aimed at strengthening the patient care experience across housing. There is a lot of literature around this app, but this was not the subject of this study. You had services where, provinces where no advertising was indicated. For instance, in the Northwest, we couldn't find information that suggests that awareness around access to services is provided. Some provinces like Western Cape and Limpopo had also information in their website. In terms of public education, again, the department pointed out a major program that they had embarked on during the time of this investigation with media houses. And for us, this sounds like one program that should be sustained because if we are able to have the media talking about this, raising awareness, you know, providing information in terms of educating the public around these issues. This would be a very good initiative. But also attached to that is the question of providing accurate information. Because as we know, this area of work is fraught with subjective beliefs. It is critical that if we go through the media, this process is monitored, that accurate information is provided to the public. The thematic areas across the provinces, you have provinces that had pretty much all the provinces except for your like the Northwest, perhaps not because they are not doing it. If they didn't mention it in our investigation, then we take it as if it's not happening, but that's another issue. But radio talks were very common, newspaper publications, waiting room health talks, home visits by community health workers, awareness campaigns, and handing out leaflets and posters in facilities were some of the modes that were used for public education. In terms of disaggregated data, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, this is a challenge across the nation. One can dare put it that way, because for us as the Commission, it doesn't matter whether we're conducting research in which sector, investigations, legal investigation across sectors. When it comes to disaggregated information, we find that we don't have a standard manner that says for this particular service, these are the kind of indicators we need to help us monitor and improve should that be a requirement. So you had different ways of presenting information when we now went to provinces, because every province had it's like they recorded information in a convenient way for them, or whatever tools they have. But what we deduced as the Commission is that it seems there's no standard requirement to disaggregate data, whether it's by race, by age, and so forth, so that we are able to make decisions based on this information. And I think our work as the Commission is exactly for that, to provide information so that the duty bearers can be able to make decisions based on the information, decide where to focus education, for instance, where to focus in terms of access, where to focus in terms of resource allocations, and so forth. So without disaggregated data that gives us direction, we are not able to say things or especially resources are allocated in a needs-based manner. So in some provinces, you would find information on the gestational period that the terminations are conducted. Sometimes you will find annual statistics of procedures that have been conducted. Some provinces, you find a number of facilities performing TOP per district, and so forth and so forth. So you did not have a standard way of reporting what is happening in facilities. And across different studies, we always recommend that we need to have standard indicators so that we can be able to report in a standard manner where required. We do take cognizance that there are different needs in different provinces. So the standardization doesn't mean everything should be the same across provinces, but it only means as a big picture, we should be able to say what we want to do and how we get to make decisions based on the information that we get disaggregated as by the demographics of the people who are getting our services. In terms of the recruitment for TOP staff, the department reported that questions for interviews are not standard and are developed in line with specific job requirements. And we have made an example there that, for instance, an advert for director women's health and genetics, for instance, would include those kinds of questions that assesses if the candidate would be able to perform or promote or access or educate. So the incumbent should be able to have a positive attitude towards TOP services. But if the job is perceived not to be related to service delivery in this regard, the questions would be excluded. And I think I don't remember if I was presenting to this committee when I made a comment that actually even the CFO, who we usually would say has nothing to do with service delivery, actually needs to understand these services, because when it comes to resource allocations, this is an incumbent who contributes to decision making in terms of where the resources go. And again, even provincially, you had a similar kind of situation, but you had a few provinces. And if off the top of my head, I think one of them was the Western Cape, where they would ask specific questions to incumbents. When the trend is similar, that they only ask these questions to incumbents who are coming into a directorate, for instance, that is responsible for reproductive health, or a service provider such as a nurse, then they would ask these specific questions around the service. In terms of complaints management, in terms of the national guidelines, each facility should have a complaints and compliments suggestion box to register the complaints of their clients. And they also have a situation where pregnant persons may register their complaints through the Mom Connect system, which again is an online system. The 7 cases were reported to have been received at the time of this study, and this related to health workers who didn't adhere to the Batupili principles. So, so we also noted that the department they submitted that data of complaints received and resolved in this regard, to analyze the turnaround times and effectiveness of the system. This was something that the department wanted to strengthen insofar as this service is concerned. The Western Cape, again, as indicated, seems to be the province that is providing more avenues in terms of complaints management, from their suggestion boxes to call centers and so forth. And other provinces would talk about we follow the Batho Pele principles. We have flow charts. Some would say we have no complaints received, which Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, when you look at the data in the report and look at the backlogs, you would realize that it's not conceivable that you would have no complaints, but we report what we found. And in terms of the turnaround time, we found that you had a range between 72 hours and 25 days, but more provinces reported 25 days as a turnaround time for resolving complaints than those that reported 72 hours. In terms of barriers to access to services, the department reported that in consultation with provinces, they developed a national guideline to manage complaints, compliments, and suggestions in public health sector in South Africa, and this was in 2017. The department acknowledged that the unwillingness of health practitioners to perform TOP services is a barrier in service delivery, and this is a very, very old, so to speak, a situation. I remember in the early 2000s when we were training health workers on the Act, when it had been passed, there was a lot to deal about in this area. And obviously, this is a situation that still exists. And we just have to keep educating in this area. And across the provinces, actually, even nationally, the issue of value clarification workshops was mentioned to all categories of health workers. So this is an ongoing training that happens to try and reduce this systemic barrier for women to access their services. However, as a commission, we are unable to get information to verify what the workshops entailed, because it would be interesting to see what kind of issues are addressed around this when you talk about issues of subjective beliefs. Similarly, in provinces, while you had provinces like the Western Cape that took it as far as including this in their HR policy, and make it a guideline that if you go against the policy, obviously there would be consequences. But generally, in other provinces, you found the issues of unwillingness being addressed through value clarification workshops, as was indicated earlier, and the issues of inadequate resources, including budget, came in. The issue of travel, as I have indicated, unequal allocations of resources. Again, it's some of the barriers that were indicated during during the investigation. Honorable members, coming to our findings. Generally, these are our general findings. There seem to be limited or no monitoring by the department on termination of pregnancy services in various provinces. And this we concluded because we saw the way the findings in the provinces came up, that, you know, each province seemed to be coping the way they know how. And one of the things that we noted was that perhaps the department needs to do more monitoring so that things are aligned, if so to speak. And this we also deduced from the observation that the department could not provide any information on this service and how it is being managed, so that while the guidelines are there, how they are implemented across provinces, we couldn't get information that verifies that to show that monitoring is happening as required for provinces to perform optimally. We also observed the lack of facilities and trained professionals across some of the provinces, resulting in backlog. And we have given a few examples like your Northwest, your Eastern Cape, and so forth. So these are some of the areas that we need to pay attention to, the remote areas, so to speak, to ensure that, especially the Northern Cape, there is like four facilities, if I remember correctly, and we know how vast the province is, and we need to pay attention to access when it comes to those. The lack of information and sensitization programs on TOP services to address issues of stigma around the issues. It was observed that in certain districts, regions or local facilities do not provide the services. The impact of this obviously is that the public is denied access to the service. We did find that in some of the provinces. And in relation to second trimester, these are limited. Similarly, the impact is that the residents in those areas are denied access. Yes, Chair.
I'm sorry to disturb you. How far are you now?
This is the second last slide, Chair.
Okay. You may continue.
So these were the findings in general. These were the observations in general, and some of the recommendations that we made are listed there. And again, it's about promoting access to terminations, to the record keeping, which is a challenge across, but we encourage that we begin to pay attention to these areas, the recruitment of healthcare professionals who are willing to perform TOP services is necessary. And we're saying this because sometimes it's difficult to change the subjective beliefs of people, although we keep educating, but we really need to monitor the people that we appoint for this service delivery. And also the issue of budget. Because when you talk about budget, it cuts across allocation equitably, it's one thing, but the availability of the budget itself, it's another thing in terms of allocations from Treasury. The bullet five is just emphasizing that. And we also recommend that the department should prioritize and embark on more sensitization programs that would reduce stigma, because this is one of the biggest systemic barriers to access to services. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. This is the end of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jamela Robertson. Thank you very much for your presentation. Colleagues, let me take this opportunity and greet everybody, all the honorable members, and greet all the staff from the department and also from Parliament, and also greet the commissioners who have logged in. Thank you very much, as I've indicated, Ms. Robertson, for your presentation. Members have indicated that they'd like to ask questions. Please note their questions and answer them after the last member have asked questions. I've noted members. The first one is the Honorable Shirwa. The second one is Honorable Wilson. The third one is the Honorable Asina. The fourth one is the Honorable Clark. Fifth is the Honorable Geller, and sixth is the Honorable Sukers. The Honorable Dr. Sophie Susanna Tembokwai has indicated she's traveling and she has sent through a question to me. I will ask on her behalf the question. Is there any other member who would like to ask questions? And if I've not noted you, you can shout over the platform. Can I start, honorable members, with the question of Dr. Sophie Susanna Tembokwai? She's asking, the first question is that Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and Northern Cape have no trained city OPs. What is the reason? And when can they be provided with trained city OPs? That is her first question. A second question will be, will the same findings be arrived at? Should the same research be applied to different facilities providing TOPS? That is the two questions from the Honorable Tembokwai. I will give over now to the Honorable Shira. Honorable Shira.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think, you know, most of my questions will be based on the fact that we, if it's possible to get a hold of the report by the CGE, because this presentation that was presented today doesn't really shed a lot of light and doesn't suffice, because now there's a need to get more details. For instance, I want to know which facilities, because there's over like 4,000 clinics and so on and so forth, right, in the country. But so we need to know which facilities don't provide TOP and which facilities provide TOP, especially because the list of the ones that do is quite a small number as compared to how many facilities we have in the country. And number two, I also want to know the demographic breakdown, like of age, race, geography, class of persons who have issues with regards to access. You know, I want to see the picture of which women remain the most vulnerable and where they stay and what race they are and what age they are. And obviously this presentation didn't shed light on that one bit. And I mean, there was a very vague example on an instance of when a case was lodged. But we don't necessarily know what has been the consequence of that. Like, can we also get instances and examples of when kids were lost with the CGE, and if they've resulted in tangible consequences, what is the outcome of some of the cases that you guys have done? If that can also be sent in writing, what's the backlog with the CGE on dealing with cases? I heard the mention of 7 cases that were lodged. How many of those 7, how many were resolved? And how do you think, or rather, what is a better strategy of publicizing information about the fact that the CGE offers this kind of support service? Because I, for one, also get a lot of complaints. I would usually share them and work with Dr. Tlaleng, who was also a commissioner in the CGE, to resolve those issues. So if we can have, like, a report just based on the cases that the CGE has dealt with and what the outcomes were. Because I am sadly getting a feeling that this is not a priority of the CGE. And the CGE is a very important institution. And we all know this, but it's almost as if with serious issues, you know, like your forced sterilization report that you guys did, which was groundbreaking, but you haven't done anything, you know, to defend that report. And now we've got this particular report. I wasn't present in the previous week, but we had that particular report on shelters in South Africa. And you've got all these findings that you do as an institution, a Chapter 9 institution, but there isn't anything tangible that we can say, oh, yes, you know, this institution did this and that, like the Public Protectors Institution, for instance. That's an example, right, of how far Chapter 9 institutions are able to go to defend their findings. So I also want to know, well, what have you guys done about this particular findings and the report? But I want to see the report first before I go into detail. But primarily, I really feel like the CGE could do much more much more than what they've given us, the women of this country. You've just given us reports. You've just given us investigations. There isn't anything tangible that you've done to change things, to implement proper consequences, to implement proper tangible manifestations of what we envision the CGE should be doing in the country. And so I would kindly like the CGE to share the report with the committee. And another question, what has been said about the issue of innovation, you know, in regards to the NDOH? For instance, some of these referrals don't really need people to go physically to clinics and hospitals. You know, why isn't there a recommendation to introduce online and telephonic consultations for referrals? You know, I mean, other countries are doing it and we're still stuck in people having to leave work just to go for a referral and then get there and then have to fill in their name on a list. Like, what are the innovative methods or recommendations that the CGE is recommending the NDOH could implement, you know, to cut down time, to cut down inconvenience? Because another thing that locks women in lack of access is the issue of convenience, or rather inconvenience. If you're going to lose your money for that day just for going to get a referral at a clinic that doesn't even offer TOP, you're most probably not going to go, and so on and so forth. And I think I've said the issue of the fact that the findings that you've shared in the presentation just don't suffice enough, because we need more details on those particular things. Like, for instance, even the issue of access, that it's multifaceted, you know, the presentation doesn't explain or give much insight on individual cases or instances of how this exactly manifests. It's too broad a presentation that you've given us in this committee for such an important issue. I can tell you for free that even today there's a termination case I have in my office today of someone who can't get, who opted to go to a private specialist because the waiting list is just too long. Today, I can even send it to you after this whole meeting so you deal with it. And I want to know of the intervention recommend, like the tangible intervention recommendations. I mean, you've noted some of them, and some of them are really important, right? That these facilities should be resourced, and that all facilities should provide TOP and stuff like that. Those are tangible interventions. But on your part, like what are you going to do as a Chapter 9 institution to see to it that, you know, the NDOH, the minister, are held accountable as well? For some of these issues that you raise that cause, you know, barriers. Because now I think an important thing to quite note is the fact that of the statistic that one in every four women who gets to carry through a pregnancy that they do not want get locked in poverty for the rest of their lives. That's the severity of this particular issue we're talking about, of people getting their livelihoods, their future prospective endeavors and stuff like that, and getting locked permanently locked in domestic violent relationships and intimate partner relationships, getting locked up in jobs when they could be pursuing education, but because they are pregnant and couldn't access termination services, getting locked up in abusive family environments and stuff like that. And the most devastating, obviously, going to seek out backstreet abortions. So this is a very important topic, but it did not get the sensitivity that it deserved on the part of the CGE with the presentation you gave us, especially because it lacks the report. So, Chairperson, through you, please advise on how we can get a hold of the report, because quite frankly, I'm very disappointed with the presentation and not hearing anything that the CGE has done to address these issues that they've given to the portfolio committee, despite the fact that they are a Chapter 9 institution. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shira. The next member is Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to the CGE for your presentation today. I have a couple of concerns and probably more statements than questions. But my first question would be, we have some idea, because I don't think we have the real idea of how many people are undergoing abortions in registered health facilities. They should be on record. We should know how many women are having them. Do we have some indication, and I know this is a very difficult question, do we have some indication, or do you have some idea of how many backstreet abortion facilities there are and how many people are actually attending those facilities? You did mention accessibility, and, you know, I'm from Limpopo, where accessibility to decent health facilities, just for the most basic of health, let alone pregnancies and abortions, is abysmal. I mean, they're just not accessible. And of course, with the rising cost of living and with great distances that our ladies have to travel, this becomes more and more difficult. And this opens doors to the backyard abortionists, who quite frankly kill in name and should not exist. The fact remains is they do. And they do because of our inequality of health and our inaccessibility to health. So that is a concern for me. And on that line, what is the CGE actually doing, and who are they partnering with to do something more about closing the backstreet abortionists down? And the damage they cause is absolutely, absolutely horrific. The other situation that we face in this country, and I think this affects what we're talking about today, is the incredible, astronomical, mind-blowing, out-of-reality rape statistics in this country. It is beyond comprehension, the extent to which our rape cases have grown. And, you know, when we start talking about a rape every few minutes in this country, we should be concerned. I think, however, we're becoming desensitized, and we mustn't let that happen. So what is the CGE doing, and who are they partnering with to address that situation? Because that situation will also be affecting the abortion statistics in this country. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of women who fell pregnancy as a result of rape or more than one rape, who honestly don't want to have the child of a rapist, and particularly when it's a man they don't know. And my third issue, and I think this is one of the most horrific things we've seen in a long time, is the statistics on teenage pregnancies, and particularly those between girls between the ages of 10 and 12. The figures are absolutely mind-blowing. So first of all, is there any decent education going around that? Do we have any indication of how many of those statistics are actually as a result of rape? Because I suspect a large amount are. And we obviously hear lots of stories about teachers involved in sexual activities with their pupils. So if you had any insights on that, I would really appreciate it. But principally, I want to know what we're doing with the backstreet abortionists, what we're doing about education, and what we're going to do about accessibility. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Wilson. The next person is Honorable Asina.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everyone. And thank you for the presentation. You know, I'm partly covered by my colleagues with regard to rape resulting in abortions, you know, in this country. Now, to the presenter. I know you have many recommendations, you know, for the National Department of Health. On that, I just have a few questions. My first question, you know, has the Commission presented the study's findings to the National Department of Health and provincial health departments? If so, you know, what were the outcomes of this? I mean, are there strategic inputs put in place that, you know, can actually address these recommendations of the CGE? My second question, from all your findings, can you identify or determine, you know, which age groups are usually mostly affected? And if yes, you know, please provide this to us. And the reason why I'm asking this is maybe we can zoom into, you know, our schools, you know, our education system, where we can actually have the empowerment there to actually educate, you know, our teenagers to what are the, you know, do's and don'ts and the effects, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe, you know, resulting in a bit more positives on the ground. My third question, I note your report states that all facilities should provide termination of pregnancy services. Now, is your recommendation based on studies due to the demand on the ground? I mean, are you working on current stats, or are you just stating that, you know, as a matter of right, the services should be provided? I'm asking this, you know, mostly taking into consideration that, you know, we don't even have enough of these healthcare workers that are actually empowered to do the necessary at point of service delivery. My fourth question, what suggestion can you provide to ensure, you know, perpetrators in the case of sexual assault and rape cases to account to be financially responsible? I particularly ask this because we know that our current, you know, economic crisis, and if you're looking at our fiscus, you know, usually we always have the scenario that there's not enough money in the budget. So how would you then also recommend or complement, you know, where we can say we can get more funds coming in to adequately address this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Asina, Honorable Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not going to put my video on because I have an unstable connection. Firstly, I would, you know, some of my colleagues have addressed some of my points, but just to build onto that, could you tell me, could they please tell me how many abortions are estimated to take place outside of public and private healthcare facilities? In your view, what are the reasons for women going to unregistered facilities? How many babies have been abandoned in the last 3 years? What is the staff vacancy rate for those who conduct TOP services? What is the breakdown per province? What is the most reoccurring type of complaints that have been received at TOP facilities? Which provinces receive the highest number of complaints? And what is the main reasons therefore? And I also would like to know, what would you say we have, you know, you said in the presentation that we have great systems, but they're not being implemented. The implementation is weak. What is your opinion that causes this, for the implementations to be weak? How do you suggest we strengthen these implementations? Do you think that other provinces could learn from the Western Cape, as you presented in your presentation, indicating that the Western Cape seems to have fairly good systems in place and seems to be striving far better in terms of service delivery? Would other provinces be able to learn from what the Western Cape has implemented? And then, Chairperson, I would really request that the Department of Health come and give us account how they are going to deal with monitoring the provinces in terms of what has been raised by the GCEs, you know, saying to us that, you know, the Department of Health have got very little interaction in terms of ensuring that that services are provided in a quality manner. So, I mean, you know, they have a role to play, and we would really like to hear from them what they are going to do in order to rectify this current situation that we're sitting in at the moment. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honourable Clark. Honourable Anna Keller.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from CGE. Chairperson, my first question has been covered by Honourable Chirwa. The issue of which facilities that are not providing TOPs. But also in their findings, Chair, they have mentioned provinces that are still struggling. For example, the Northwest and also Free State. The Free State is the issue of transport. But also, I just want to check, Chairperson, in those provinces they have already done they've met with the provincial leadership of those provinces, and what was their response in terms of responding? But also, Chairperson, the other issue is that South Africa battles with various health conditions, such as a non-communicable disease, as well as maternal and child mortality. So why should more investment be made for TOP services. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Keller. The last one will be the Honorable Mary Elizabeth Sukers.
Thank you, Chairperson. And it is a long time that somebody has actually called me by my full names. I would most likely just start by what Honorable Gela has said in a last comment in terms of the costs. I do not know of if, as part of the study, there has been made a cost analysis of what is the cost of abortion services nationally and then the breakdown provincially, because it would be good for us as a committee to know what the cost is. Then secondly, we cannot take away that the termination of pregnancy is a very emotive subject. And I think the request by Honorable Chirwa around, a full report that would provide us with a picture of, termination of pregnancy in terms of this research and the other elements that pertains to that, that it would be good for the committee to see. And for various reasons. And one of it is that some of the aspects that I just want to get clarity on in terms of the presentation is one, there was a mention made of the HR policy, and I think it was the Western Cape that was flighted, that provides protection to both the client seeking the service and the professional staff who has conscientious objection. It is not clear to me, however, how conscientious objection is accommodated from the presentation. And there is a concern to be noted in terms of the word sensitized and breach of contract. It seems to me when it comes to the termination of pregnancy that the religious sensitivities and the convictions of people, which is the majority, I am assuming, of South Africans around this, is not considered. And it definitely does not come out in the presentation that is being provided. There is not just one narrative in terms of the termination of pregnancy. And I need to emphasize that, Chair, because we live in a country where many people, and especially African people, would have serious conscientious objections to termination of pregnancy. So you cannot just do research from the perspective of abortion as the only alternative where a woman is having a crisis pregnancy. So the other elements, as raised by Honorable Chirwa, obviously from a different standpoint, are very important, and it would be very good to see a report that is comprehensive in that regard. So the question is, how protected are physicians, nurses, and other health professionals who have conscientious objection to termination of pregnancy? Because what we are seeing here is the aggressive narrative that is that, abortion is part of, it's a sexual reproductive health right, and that it should be available. But you cannot just look at it within that context. You need to be very sensitive around the other elements that are certainly present. I serve on basic education, and the amount of teenage pregnancies over the last 2 years, especially within the age group of 9, 10 years old, has significantly, and we are in crisis where that is concerned, we are significantly seeing more and more preteens being pregnant, falling pregnant. The context within which that happens, of course, is a different subject, but it points again to the issue of statistics. As part of that, we need to know what is the breakdown of those that are seeking termination of pregnancy, so that we'd be able to have a map of how does it look like on the ground, because the issue of cost, as highlighted by Honorable Gela, is one. But the second most important is that you live in a country where you have a health budget that is under huge pressure. So we need to know the costing of things. And I would steer away from the word empowerment as it relates to termination of pregnancy because of the softer issues around and softer but hard issues, which is conviction, religious belief and conviction. We cannot steer away from that. And we certainly cannot say people need to become sensitized and children needs to be exposed. Or being told about, you know, the pros and cons of an abortion and spoken about abortion. You can't do it in isolation. So empowerment should not be coercion, and the constitutional rights of health workers are not considered or accommodated, it seems, in this narrative as it is presented today. And I know in most narratives, abortion is being pushed as, you know, as a sexual reproductive right and a democratic right and a constitutional right. And yes, of course, that is where it stands in terms of the law. But we are not just dealing with the law here. We're dealing with real issues that are on the ground. So it would be good to see how this really looks like on the ground, Chair. And I want to again stipulate that I want really to ask that we get feedback on how is the rights of health workers being accommodated, or are people being forced to forego their religious beliefs and their convictions in order to press this? If we put the same amount of effort, and I want to ask the question, has there been made a research around education, access to education, as the same is there a research paper around access to education that one of the biggest barriers that we're having in terms of economic development is that? So has there been such a research made by the Commission on Gender Equality as to how women particularly are having access to education in order for them to exercise choice in terms of their life? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Sukers. That was the last member. I must confess, Honorable Sukers, when I saw that smile on your face, that's exactly what we're asking every day when we start the day, to say, God, please make us to make smiles on people's faces. Thanks. When I called all your numbers, it was deliberate for yourself and Honorable Sophie, Susanna Tembokwaya. Honorable members, just one question from my side. I think the Honorable Tembokwaya touched on one of my questions in terms of the number of trained CTOPs in provinces like the Western Cape, the Eastern Cape, and the Northern Cape. She touches me. Just one question from my side, Honorable Ms. Robertson, is the issue of the few facilities in the Northern Cape. The Northern Cape is having 4 facilities. And you have quite correctly mentioned that there are no facilities in far-flung areas, and the Northern Cape is very vast, and the Northern Cape has got small areas in very far areas, and there are no facilities. How does this affect the Northern Cape, per se? Thank you very much. Then I'll give over to you, Ms. Jamela Robertson, to answer the questions. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In terms, I think, Honorable Chair, as you were adding or emphasizing the first question from Honorable Sophie, in terms of the Northern Cape. This, I think, for us as the Commission, when we conduct these investigations, because this is an investigation report, but there are also research reports. What we find is what we report. And this relates to various questions around what the CGE is doing about these weaknesses that we identified. As the issues of jurisdiction comes in here, as a Chapter 9 institution, we are defined as a watchdog. We monitor the performance of the country. We make recommendations. We follow up on the recommendations and, excuse me, and our Establishing Act specify how far we can go in terms of follow-up. So when we have presented to the relevant entities that oversee the provision of services, that's where we will follow up what has happened. This report was produced in March 2021. So there hasn't been a follow-up study in that regard. But obviously, with all our reports, we schedule them in our APP to say this year, after so many years, because you monitor today, you can't go tomorrow and want to see progress. So periodically, we look at our reports and our recommendations, and then we go forth to monitor. In terms of what the CGE is going to do about it, the CGE reports on the performance of the public, of the system that it is investigating. And then different duty bearers need to play a part, collaborate to address those issues. As honorable members will see, some of the findings don't only need the Department of Health to intervene. Honorable member, sorry, I can't find the honorable member's name in my notes. Was talking about the role of education in this regard. So you can see that as we identify these weak areas in our service delivery, we need to collaborate across departments. When I presented in the beginning, I did indicate that when it comes to education, we also have as a commission a public education department that works with provincial departments in terms of providing public education. Also to clarify that a report was submitted with a long presentation a few weeks ago. And yes, the report has detailed information that fills the gaps in terms of the presentation as it was. We were requested to shorten it. And that, you know, left a lot of gaps in the presentation. The question regarding which facilities provide TOP, I have reported in this presentation that the issue of disaggregated data is a challenge across. So if you look at the report, you'll find especially that variable of disaggregated data, which was part of the study. That is exactly what we're trying to establish. But what we found is that in one province, you would be given a number of TOPs that have been conducted. And mainly when this study was conducted, we were given information from 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021 in different provinces. So there are ballpark figures, in annual ballpark figures in terms of the procedures conducted. And when it comes to age, as I was saying, that disaggregated data is intended to help duty bearers in our different areas of work to be able to make decisions informed by the statistics coming out of the work that we do. So in our case, I mentioned the issue of gender, race, and age as I was presenting, because if even when you look through the report, there are no statistics that are broken down in terms of age. But you will find that some provinces would report that when they provide education, they separate under 18s and over 18s and give them different talks. And we, because that was not elaborated in the information that we received, we couldn't comment in terms of what kind of education is given to under 18s and over 18s. In terms of the consequences of the cases that we have identified, the commission investigates cases that are reported to it. Our act mandates us to do that. So when a lady from who was turned away, the example I made from the Shawelo Clinic, reported to the CGE, we intervened in terms of her accessing the service, and she did access the service. This is just the one example. But in terms of consequences regarding the staff member who turned her away, that now falls outside our jurisdiction. That's why we're making this report, so that the department, the national department, should be able to follow up on that. Should there be issues of consequence management or whatever the situation may be, why this woman was turned away. So a lot of these things, the CGE has a mandate to start from here and stop here, and then other duty bearers need to take over and implement. That is why this work and many other work that we do, it don't require one particular entity to intervene. It requires all of us to play our role so that we eventually see a difference at the end of the day in terms of the interventions that we put in place. There was a question around, and I think I have pretty much responded, but I will just go a bit into detail. The question about, we have all these reports, we have all this work that we're doing, but what tangible results can we show as the commission? And again, it goes back to that situation where I had said our act allows us to do certain things. We intervene where we can intervene. Sometimes we even go as far as subpoenaing entities to appear, because our legal investigations, our recommendations are binding, unlike research recommendations, which are not. But we still follow up and try to make sure that our recommendations are implemented, and where they are not, we subpoena departments to account. We also report to portfolio committees and also to departments that we have who are responsible for what we are investigating. So, and from there we monitor the implementation of our recommendations. For instance, as the commission, we cannot hold a public service official to accountable in a sense of disciplining them, if you like. We will surface the problem, and then the relevant entity needs to do all the other work that is remaining in that sense. The issue of innovation, in reading the report, I don't think we had any recommendations around that. And for me, some of the questions or comments that members are making, it's a note for us to improve in terms of the kind of questions we ask when we conduct these investigations, so that we are able to also make recommendations that are progressive, so to speak. If you look at issues of technology, as I understand the Honourable Members was alluding to, in terms of the issues of referral, do we have to send women running around across remote areas for services when we can have online interventions? And I have reported in the presentation that in some provinces, you did have referral systems or complaint systems that are online. So this is just for us as the commission. I would take this as a recommendation that as we go, or actually we are in the IR4, we need to integrate that in when we conduct our research and our investigations. Just looking at. Okay, the question of how many women conduct or receive TOP services, how many facilities conduct backyard terminations. This is in the statistics, in the report, per province, you have those annual statistics that will tell you 16,000, 17,000, 20-something thousands. So provincially, you get those, but you don't get a breakdown of who are these 18,000, for instance, in terms of their race, gender, and so forth. And from our side as the commission, we can't emphasize enough. That's why I use the example of across sectors. We have a problem when it comes to disaggregated data. And it's hence, it's something where we were saying we need to standardize processes and have indicators that will help service providers to be able to disaggregate data as we require it, so that we can be able to use this data to make decisions, including resource allocation decisions. We, as far as I know, as the commission, we have not conducted a study that wants to determine how many facilities are conducting backyard abortion. But when one speaks to other research, and this relates to why women choose to go or are forced, or whatever reasons make them go to backstreet terminations. While we haven't done research in this regard, as far as I know, based on previous research, you don't get a facility that is established to conduct backstreet abortions. And I think the law and the Department of Health would perhaps attest to that, because I don't think that is something you would do openly. It's illegal, and people are doing it secretly. In some instances, you had certain health professionals. Bear with me, honorable members, because I'm making an old example of the 80s, where you had health professionals who will do those for women. And back then, of course, there was no law, or services were not legalized at that stage. So it's still that kind of situation, that back streets are secret, and women go to them for different reasons. Many different reasons why women don't want to do this in a public facility. And the reasons are endless. Some people don't want to be found out that they have terminated a pregnancy. In terms of who we partner with, actually, one can say we have a whole range of stakeholders depending on the topic that we are working on. Around issues of health, including the issue of TOP, we work a lot with both the national and provincial departments, as honorable members have made other examples. And as I've indicated, when it comes to public education, sometimes we partner going to communities to do education. When it comes to investigations like the forced sterilization, as the member has alluded to, we follow up on the recommendations that we have provided to the department to see that they are implemented by the department, and that has been happening. In terms of the rape statistics and the statistics on teenage pregnancy, how many result from rape, These are issues that we haven't formally investigated as the commission. But when the statistics came, especially on teenage pregnancy, and we found that even 10-year-olds were getting pregnant in their thousands, tens of thousands, as the statistics have shown, we have gotten involved and put out public statements to say, we really need, there is a need to identify how these 10-year-olds got pregnant, because this is statutory rape and the perpetrators must be arrested. But these are some of the recommendations that we make. Obviously, as the commission, we can't go and arrest, but we will make that recommendation to the relevant entity to look at this. And I think there was an uptake and some discussion in the country around how we deal with these kinds of situations where 10-year-olds are getting pregnant, and obviously we know that is rape, but we haven't really gone and done an investigation in terms of who are the perpetrators in that regard. Perhaps this is one of the projects that we can conceptualize as the commission and begin to drill deep into these things. But what remains is we will drill deep, make our findings, make our recommendations, and the duty bearers need to implement eventually. Lastly, if I may perhaps allude, I'm not defending in terms of saying what's wrong and what's right. We do acknowledge that the issues of TOP are highly emotive, and other issues that are happening in the country. And what I said in my introduction when I talked about the CTOP Act was that the reason for the act to be put in place was to mitigate the unnecessary deaths. So eventually, as a constitutional democracy, we all have the right to our opinions. But from where I've been working, we don't want to force people to do what they don't believe in doing. But we do emphasize that we are implementing the constitution. And I want to believe, and if you look at some provinces' responses, they talk about appointing people who are willing. So you have those situations where people are willing and they are able to understand that their personal beliefs should not be to the detriment of another person. So it's not a black and white situation. You can't put a finger on it and say, this is right, this is wrong. We do the best we can to make recommendations that says, let's recognize people's human rights. But at the same time, we have a right to our own beliefs, as we know, as a country. So that when you look at the provinces, people deal with it in different ways. In the Western Cape, they put a policy in place, which, of course, is deemed harsh. Perhaps their context required that. They do that. And the detail in terms of that is something else. Why did they have to put it in a policy? What prompted that? Why are other provinces just settling for doing value clarification workshops and put the case forward for health workers to see why this is necessary? And I also in the presentation indicated that TOPs are not the alternative for family planning. That's why you have some provinces conducting family planning counseling, because eventually that these are the last resort to save women's lives because they were dying unnecessarily so. Honorable members, I'm trying to clump the questions as they came. Honorable Clark has asked quite a few questions in terms, some related to the breakdown of information, which I have spoken to as I was talking about the issue of the lack of disaggregated data. But when it comes to the, you know, why is there a lack of services, especially as it pertains to access in terms of distances? And I know honorable members have expressed that agreement that yes, we do have a problem with that. But the question of what are we going to do about it? That is why I was presenting that these are the issues where the duty bearers need to make improvements, especially in the Northern Cape. We need to look at that situation and make sure that we try and limit the access problems in that province. But yes, it speaks to that things of analysis. One honorable member spoke to budget analysis. And when we were talking about the funding model, I did explain how you people know they get a vote fund or the equitable share, but you don't get the detail, which we keep saying we need to have that analysis so that we allocate in a needs-based manner when we allocate budget. But then these are things that falls within your departments like Treasury, the Department of Health, negotiating all those kinds of things to say when we allocate budget, being cognizant that as a country, we have limited resources, but how do we allocate in a way that responds to needs so that those who have been previously disadvantaged don't continue to be previously, to continue to be disadvantaged. The Western Cape, honorable members, I agree that it's one of those pockets of excellence in the country, and it would help for the Western Cape to be emulated. But we also need to remember that sometimes provinces perform better because they have better resource allocations. So, for instance, if you want to take Limpopo and say emulate the Western Cape, you will find that Limpopo, when it comes to resources, is not able to do that, which is where now we need to say, how do we ensure that Limpopo is able to perform, which boils back to that budget analysis and also informed by the population needs of the province. The issue of access to education in relation to this matter, I think the education, I mean, in my presentation, I think I said education times three, because we know the issues of TOP access affecting the poor, it's all historical and related. And I keep saying in this democracy, we're trying to address that. We're trying to minimize the inequalities. And again, of course, we educate at the level of community education. And obviously you have the school system, the education system that plays its part in that regard as we gradually try to inform people so that we as a country, we don't find ourselves with a problem like this. I don't know in how many years, but that's where we are trying to go in terms of educating and empowering women economically. So that because we do know that contributes, it's not a cause and effect, but it contributes to this situation as well. Okay, lastly, the issue, I think I've addressed whether health workers are being coerced regardless of their beliefs in terms of faith. And I have indicated how different provinces are doing things because, yes, this is an emotive situation. And people, we have guidelines, we have the law, we have issues of equal human rights. We have the notion that my personal convictions shouldn't be an shouldn't be to the detriment of another person. So balancing the scales there is something that we need to work on so that eventually we don't derogate either the right of the health workers or the rights of patients who need this service. Honorable members, I think I've come to the end of my notes. I should confess that sometimes the questions were coming too fast, and as I was noting, I may have missed some. And if that's the case, I will appreciate if I may be reminded which questions I didn't respond to. Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Robertson. Sorry, Mr. Jamela Robertson. Thank you very much for your responses. There are just two quick follow-up questions, two quick, short follow-up questions. One is from the Honorable Sukers, and the other one is from the Honorable Shirwa. Honorable Sukers?
Yes, Chair. Chair, thank you, and thank you for the reply by the Commission. I did not hear at all. I just went back to the communication that we've received around the presentation today. I received, I think it was a two-page, I don't know if that is the report that is being referred to. So if we can just get clarity, if that is the report, or if there is a report that I may have missed. But the report that I have basically focuses on the scope of the investigation. And I want to, and the scope of the investigation, it seems, is to look at the promotion of termination of pregnancy, which in itself is problematic. Because the whole issue that has been raised by the different members here, is it the issue around seeing termination of pregnancy within the context of the health basket available to South Africans at large and specifically to women. So it is important to understand, what was the aim of this? Is it not just the accessibility of service, which forms part of the scope, but also the promotion of termination of pregnancy? Because if you are saying that is the standpoint from which you are doing the investigation, then what I am saying is the gaps around the holistic basket of services when it comes to termination of pregnancy, which is the pre and post counseling services that are non-existent. Certainly this investigation should have that as a part of it, because it has to do with the holistic services to the person seeking termination of pregnancy. That is number one. And number two is the fact that abortion doesn't just happen and the woman gets up and there she goes. And I certainly know I'm not undermining the commission here in terms of saying this, but I'm saying it in terms of a study like this or an investigation like this needs to provide service with those elements of spiritual, emotional impact of abortion to be also included. What is the impact of it on women? And because it has an impact on women, what is being done in terms of the services to ensure that the spiritual and emotional needs of women, when they have undergone such a drastic action to terminate a pregnancy, is that they are actually looked after? Because I can tell you it's not happening. So we cannot look at abortion services, access and promotion of it just in isolation. You cannot, not in a country where 70% of people are Christian. You cannot. And you certainly need to then ensure that the full basket of services are there in order for women to be looked after. And I'm saying to you, and I'm putting it to the commission, it is not, and it is definitely not clear from the standpoint or the scope of that the commission has taken. Secondly, the issue of incongruence here. How can we say that a child falling pregnant, there should be criminal prosecution, and at the same time advocate for choice when it comes to basic education and comprehensive sexuality education? We have a problem in that we are dealing with issues in isolation and not dealing with it holistically and together. And it would serve well for the commission to please take note of these issues, because these issues are not coming. It comes from us being on the ground in our constituencies, working in the different communities that we are working in. It would really, we really need to note that. You cannot, the issue of teenage pregnant or preteen pregnancies is a major crisis that we are facing. You cannot tell children on the one end that you cannot have, that it is criminal, and to the people who perpetrate these things, and at the same time say to children, at the same time that, you know, sexual rights promote that. You need to decide which standpoint you take. And the point that I want to make is that you need to make allowance for a value-based approach to all of this. I have a serious concern with the standpoint made by the presenter in her answer. Belief is a human right. It is problematic statement by the presenter to say that you cannot, it's not either or. In fact, it must be both. You must protect the health worker, and it's a problem if the Western Cape is making it a breach of contract for health workers. I want to make that point, Chair. Then we need to take it up with the Western Cape Provincial Department. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Sukers. Comrade, Honourable Members, we are running against time. Honourable Shira.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I think I don't want to let this manipulation that's done on the committee by the CGE to go without being taken up. The CGE must not pretend that they're like an NGO that is tied, that can't do anything about the reports and the investigations that they do. You're a Chapter 9 institution. Part of your responsibility is also public education. I asked you questions pertaining to that. You're not shedding light in the way that you should. Number two, you also have the option of exploring the opportunities that are held in our justice or criminal law system. You can go for litigation. You have not done that. I'll give you examples and instances where you could have done that. For instance, with the forced sterilization issue, you could have easily taken the NTOH to the Concord or gone through the process of taking them to the Concord because they have not implemented any of the recommendations that you did. This is 2 years ago. As a Chapter 9 institution, you do not defend those recommendations. Number two, you come up with findings that children are falling pregnant and that there's a high probability that they are being raped and that this must be investigated. This is not being done. Again, as a Chapter 9 institution, you're not doing anything about it. You're waiting for them, the people that you should be watchdogs over, you're waiting for them to have a change of heart. Even though we've known this for decades on end, that South Africa has an issue and a crisis of rape, you as a commission for gender equality that's entrusted with ensuring that women in this country are protected, you have not done anything about it. So as I'm asking you, what are you doing with the reports that you have? Which ones have you taken to court? Which ones have you held ministers and their departments accountable for the work that they are not doing? You're not an NGO. You are a Chapter 9 institution. If you don't know your functions, check your peers. Check what's happening in the Office of the Public Protector. Check what's happening with the AG. Check how they're taking cases to the SIU and stuff like that. So you cannot pretend or maneuver to behave like an NGO when you are not an NGO. You're a Chapter 9 institution that should hold these people accountable, not just write reports. So that's why I'm asking that even with this particular thing, what are you going to do about it as a Commission for Gender Equity? Noting that people, women, are not getting access to termination of pregnancies, even though it's their primary right. What are you, as the CGE, who has done these findings, who are going to do all these recommendations, going to, because we know for a fact the NGOH will not implement your recommendations. So you, as the CGE, noting your history with the fact that your recommendations are never implemented by ministers and departments, what are you then going to do to ensure that they are like other Chapter 9 institutions are doing in this country? Please, you can't behave like an NGO in this country. And maybe it's the problem of the current leadership. Maybe the current crop of leadership has too much allegiance and loyalty to certain factions, to certain political parties, to certain leaders in the country. We can't afford that. The women of this country can't afford that commissioners have allegiance and loyalty to people and not the women of this country. So if the issue is leadership, it will also start showing very soon because other institutions are doing what they're supposed to do and you're telling us about jurisdiction. What's stopping you from going to the courts? What is stopping the CGE from going to the courts? Please don't manipulate us. You're not an NGO. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honorable Shira. Ms. Jamela Robertson, can you please respond to these two last questions? There's also a note that the Honorable Sukers have sent me to ask who has requested the investigation. Please just touch on that as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just noting the last question. The investigation. Thank you, Honourable Members. One has to acknowledge that this is one of those difficult areas when it comes to the work that we do as a commission. And obviously, Honourable Members have highlighted that it is an emotive area of work. And specifically noting that belief is a human right as well. And I think in my previous response, I suppose I was trying to speak to this. When I say the law is there, the services are there. We're trying to reduce maternal mortality as a country because unnecessary deaths were happening. But some of the issues really, for me, it's a debate that can take, you know, that actually I would say it's a debate that we must continue until we find each other. Because at the same time, it sounds like a contradiction, but the services need to be rendered to address the problem that we have. How we do it, how we recognize the rights of providers and patients, it's a dialogue that we need to continue with as a country, actually, and across sectors. I keep saying, because like I said in my presentation, this is not the kind of work that can be implemented by one entity and one entity alone. So it's just to acknowledge that much as the investigation looked at the issue of access, as per the list of variables that I started with when I presented the methodology, those were the elements that we looked at. And the idea was to see if the Act is being implemented as it should. You know, when we, I don't want to put...
And then somebody mutes me when
you're... Sorry for that. I don't know what is happening. You can continue, Ms. Robertson.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, I was just trying to emphasize that as the commission, we investigated the issue of access because we wanted to see how far the Act has been taken. And I think prior studies were done before my time in the CGE, but this was one of the studies where we specifically wanted to see how access is happening in as far as the law is concerned. And this is not to say when we look at access, we look at it as if it's in isolation, regardless of other factors that contribute to the issues of factors, as I have presented the barriers. It's just that when you do an investigation of or a research, you have a criteria, and sometimes you can't cover absolutely everything. The variables that I listed at the time of this study, this is what we wanted to look at. And I emphasize when we talk about promotion, I said that before, that it's not promoting TOP as the first step to preventing unwanted pregnancy. That's why we have family planning counseling in some of the provinces where they have enough resources to do that. So it all boils back to the issue of resources. So this is, I know in the early 2000s, one of the initiatives taken by the Department of Health was to promote comprehensive health care in primary health care services. And that has happened. But again, it's that question of some things are still falling through the cracks. And when we do a study in this area, we pick a topic and an issue that we need to focus on. And like I said before, some of the comments that are coming from the honorable members are, for me, I'm noting them as recommendations for improving the way we do our work, because there's always room for improvement.
Point of order, Chairperson.
Okay, Honorable Shira.
Chairperson, I'm very sorry to be doing this, quite honestly. But my first set of questions were not answered. And now my follow-up question is not being answered. I just want to know what's stopping the CGE from pursuing the route of going to the courts like other Chapter 9 institutions when their recommendations are not being implemented? Can it not be a vague response to my question, but can it be answered that we are not going to the courts because, number one, we don't have money, number two, this and this and that, so that we know why the CGE is not doing its job as a committee?
Okay, thanks.
Just my question is answered. Thank you very much.
Okay, you can continue, Ms. Robert. So please just touch on the issue of why don't you not go to court.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think the first set of questions, hopefully they were from Honorable Sukus. I hope I have covered that sufficiently. Honorable Shiro, in terms of litigating, I do know that there are cases that have been litigated, not necessarily the forced sterilization or this particular one. And I do know that in our APP for 2022-23, there are projects that for litigation. So there are certain maybe cases that were not litigated and were in the public eye. And I'm not trying to defend. Maybe we're not doing that enough. And we need to, hence, there was an effort planning going forward that there are some cases that we have done where we need to litigate in that regard. But I know in the past, much as I can't off the top of my head say this case and that case and that case, but I do know the CGE has gone to court on certain cases. And last year when I joined, there was a case where we were going to court around issues of maintenance and other projects. So I don't want to sit and antagonize. We take the recommendations, we take the inputs, perhaps we're not doing enough, but we do what our act directs us to do. I have indicated that we subpoena departments in as far as if they don't implement our recommendations. We do have a public education department in the CGE where we partner with different departments depending on the topic of education. So these are some of the things that we have. And in terms of why the issue of 10-year-old roads are not being investigated, I know we got these statistics sometime mid or late last year. And again, this I have noted and indicated that perhaps these are some of the projects that we need to follow up on in terms of looking at why this is happening, because we know if a 10-year-old is pregnant, it's statutory rape. Eventually. But there was also a comment saying we're saying statutory rape and on the rape, and on the other side, we're promoting sexual and reproductive rights. And again, it's one of those things where a balance must be struck, basically, because yes, a 10-year-old cannot, you can't say a 10-year-old has given informed consent. And that is just by the nature of how we judge situations as people, not only in this country. A 10-year-old can't be said to have given consent. But at the same time, when we promote sexual and reproductive health, the education itself, we have the law that says you can consent at a particular age. But the main situation around sexual and reproductive health, it's about people, both men and women, being able to make decisions about their bodies and be able to access the services that are provided in the public service. So we need to strike a balance that when we talk about sexual rights, we're not saying 10-year-olds can consent on sex. So that's how I would look at the matter. Hence, this is not a very easy area to deal with, because it has a lot of what would be seen as contradictions. When you look at the situations, you will see why things are presented the way they are. Thank you, Chair.
The Chair has already appeared on the screen. Our time is up. Ms. Njamela, just one clarity, because Ms. Sukers, Honorable Sukers, is insisting that you have not responded. Who requested the investigation?
Sorry. The investigation, Honorable Chair, I would have to, if you allow me, because I read the report which was initiated, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to make an excuse. It was initiated before my time, but what prompted it, I'm not sure yet, but I can provide a written response in that regard, because that's not an issue I have looked at, though with some reports I had it had indicated why it was initiated. So thanks. If Honorable Sukers can allow me to do that.
Thanks, Mr. Roberts. That's clear. You will have to check on it and come back to us in writing to indicate what is the origins of this investigation. Colleagues, the report was emailed to all of us on the 3rd of March with the presentation. I just want to indicate that. Once more from my side, Mr. James Jamela Robertson, thank you very much for the report. Is there any conclusion remarks that you would like to make?
On my side, Honorable Chair?
Yes.
Just to thank the committee, because for us, we feel that when we are able to be given platforms to present our results, it is support, because we're giving you the information that will help the committee as best as possible to intervene where necessary. So thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Robertson. Colleagues, the chair already, he was already on the screen, he's back. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity. And would therefore like to give you back your meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sukacha, for managing that meeting so well as a chairperson. I've been able to listen intermittently as I was moving between two towns and trying to stay on the system. I think just before Ms. Robertson goes, and I've heard you giving an opportunity to give a concluding remark, I think as a chairperson also I'd like to maybe just reiterate what was mentioned by some of the members, that the CGE, being a Chapter 9 institution, should have more bite in terms of many of the issues which they deal with. And number two, that from what I've listened from the honorable members, there are many questions and suggestions and on the study that was done, and that the study does not necessarily reflect many of those points which they had raised, and that you do well for Ms. Robertson to note those points. And I would just, and I'm sorry, Honorable Sukacha, but I would have to say this. It's an indictment against us that we have 9 to 10 year olds becoming pregnant, and that we talk about consent and we talk about criminal charges. A number of years back, you'd never ever have heard this. So when one thinks in terms of human reproduction, then something is seriously wrong apart from society, that 9 to 10 year olds can become pregnant. But at the same time, when these young girls become pregnant, it could necessarily also mean that the boys can father those babies much earlier now also. So in terms of human reproduction abilities, it doesn't necessarily mean that those who impregnate these children are adult men or are older boys who could be culpable of, possibly culpable of statutory rape. I would ask Ms. Robertson that you really look into this more, much more in depth so that we can, would be able to take our society forward. And I started off by saying this is a serious indictment against us as a society and as a country that we are facing these challenges. So I implore you as the chairperson within the powers which are given to you as a Chapter 9 institution that you maybe broaden the scope of that study or have a new study with regards to this. So thank you very much for coming to do this presentation, honorable members. We are going to move on to our next project, and you're very welcome to leave the platform, Ms. Robertson, if you so wish. We will continue, honorable members, and deal with some minutes which we need to consider and adopt, and then we will be talking on the study tour. Thank you very much. Honorable Ms. Majolamba, would you be able to flight those minutes for us, please?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honorable members. Goodbye.
Bye. Honorable members, there we have the minutes of the 15th of February, page 1. Have a look to see whether you had been noted as being present and if you had apologized on page 2. And then we see the support staff and the Department of Health representatives. We can move to page 3. We noted the three stakeholders, AfriForum, PASATU, South African Communist Party, on the NHI public hearings. Anything on page 3? Page 4. And you would have received these minutes, honorable members. Page 5. Page 6. Page 7. And page 8. Noting that the meeting recording is available on request. Can I ask for a mover to adopt these minutes? Anyone to move adoption minutes?
I so move that we adopt the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Sukacha. Any seconder?
I'm seconding, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Gela. Ms. Majalam. Minutes of the 16th of February, 2022, page 1. Again, are you present? Have you been marked present? And page 2, if you had apologized. Page 3. We see we had the South African Committee of Medical Deans and the HALU. Page 5. Page 6. Page 7. That's the last page. Honorable members, can I ask for somebody to move for adoption of these minutes?
Chairperson.
Yes.
I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Gela.
There was a question that was asked by Honorable Philip of the document, whether they've been banned. They were also affected during the banning of Parliament, which you have indicated that will get response. But also I want members to note that it is also captured in the minutes. So that for honorable members to note that, because Honorable Ishmael keep on asking. So I wanted just to say that, Chairperson, but also can emphasize more so that members must not be worried. Our information regarding the NHI is safe, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Gela. Honorable Ishmael, you raised your hand.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to respond at the day of the DA's presentation. You know, I think you did send us the edited minutes of the 15th. So thank you. I've noted it already there. I did send a thank you email to Vuyo as well, our secretary. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bajalamba, please, the next set of minutes, if you can flight it. Honourable members, the minutes of the 26th. Page one, are you there? Page two, if you had apologized. Page three. Page four. Page six. Page 7. Is that page 8, the last one? Can I ask for adoption? Somebody to move for adoption of the minutes, please.
Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the minutes. Or there's somebody before that? I can hear somebody.
Sorry, Chair, before the adoption of the minutes, there's a typo on the date. It says 22nd. The minutes, they are the minutes of the 23rd.
Yes, you are correct. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'll correct. Thank you, Chair.
With that correction, Chair, I move for the adoption of the minutes.
With the correction, Honorable Sukacha, of the date. Thank you very much. Any seconder for that, for the adoption of those minutes?
I'm seconding, Chair.
Thank you very much. Majalamba, do we have the last set of last week? Honorable members, we have done very well on our minutes. We must compliment the staff that we are so on time with our minutes as a committee. So this is the last set of minutes before today's meeting, 2nd of March 2022. Please note whether you have been noted as present or having had apologized. Page 3, page 4, page 5, page 6, page 7, page 8. Any mover for adoption of these minutes?
Chairperson,
I move.
I've got my hand up.
I'm trying to see hands where I am now. Let me see. Yes, Honorable Clark.
Chairperson, just a correction on the minutes. In terms of the attendance, they've put a member Gwarube's name in instead of mine.
Yes.
They could just fix that up, please, Chairperson.
Yes, I'm certain the secretary will correct that?
Thank you.
So before we then do adoption, with the amendment of the two names which will be exchanged, anybody to wants to move for the adoption of the minutes of the 2nd of March?
Okay.
Yes?
I said I'll move for adoption, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Van Staden. I think that's your voice. Thank you very much. Right, any
yes.
Seconder?
I'm seconding, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Gela. Honorable members, that brings us to the end of the minutes. Ms. Majalamba, maybe you can inform me, since I was now running up and down, apart from the study tour, is there anything else that we were to have discussed?
No,
Sorry, Chair. Honorable Wilson, there's one issue I'd like to raise, please.
You may raise that issue now, Honorable Wilson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, it's been 2 years now since we've been basically holding virtual meetings for the portfolio of health. It's been made abundantly clear to all of us that there is now more than sufficient space for portfolio meetings to be actually held on the precinct in Cape Town. Can we please make arrangements for the start of the next term to have one-on-one face meetings in committee rooms in Cape Town? It really does make a very big difference. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Clark. Your hand is also raised.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I have to echo what my colleague has said. I also raised my hand to discuss that very aspect. Now, I also think in terms of teamwork. I mean, I take myself. I haven't met the team of this committee as yet. And I think it would, in terms of team spirit as well, it would also be great that we meet in person. I mean, the rest of the country is back at work. And I think, us as leaders should be really following that pursuit. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Van Staden.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I want to echo other colleagues' points that were raised on this matter. I think we were the first committee, but when the level 5 lockdown started, we set the example to go into hybrid or this Zoom meetings to show the country that we are responsible. And I think we must now take the liberty on us to be the first committee to go back into a normal meeting. We know what's going to happen in a few weeks' time or what the president's going to be announced. We are waiting for that family meeting. And I think we must take a lead in this situation. The numbers is down. The deaths is down. We are going, the whole world is going back to normal. I see in Britain, Denmark, and all those other places, even the United States. And I think we as a committee must take a lead in this example. And I think we must start with our ordinary meetings. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Honourable Members, there has been an issue raised about physical meetings. Are there any of the other members who would want to speak on this point?
Chairperson, I think you will check whether can we go back physically as portfolio committee. I hope all members have already vaccinated when you want us to meet physically. We must lead by example. All of us, we must be vaccinated as health portfolio committee members so that at least we can give the country the confidence that we lead by example, as members are saying, let's go back to Parliament and have a physical meeting. So, Chairperson, in that regard, I think we'll hear from you whether do we have a venue that we can have to attend a physical in Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
I also wanted to second what Honourable Caleb said in terms of the venue. And all those things, nitty-gritties and so on. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Honorable Ismail, I see you raise your hand again.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to put my 5 cents in to say I totally agree that we should be meeting physically. It's about time, you know, everything goes back to normal in the country. However, I do object to what Honorable Gela has stated. The country has not reached any decision. There is no decision on mandatory vaccines taken as a country. And I think that statement is actually, you know, inconclusive and shouldn't be actually be used as a mandate to say every member should be vaccinated to be able to attend the meeting. I agree that everybody should be attending physically, and I want to attend physically. I think we all want to get back to normal, but that is uncalled for, and that is should not be a stance of mandatory, especially since the country, you know, no, there's been no proclamation to say that South Africa has made it mandatory on vaccinations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Chairperson. Can I speak? I know that vaccination is not mandatory, but what I'm saying to members, let us all get vaccine, be vaccinated, so that we lead by example as a country. That's what I'm saying, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I do note all the points that you have raised. It starts with request for a physical meeting. When that would be is another question which I will speak to now. Number two is that there is a request that that members should be vaccinated, and I do get Honorable Ismail's point about vaccination not being mandatory. I think what we will do is we'll get the get a writing to the chair of chairs, because that process is something that is outside of our hands. We can simply write a request and then hear what the answer would be that we receive. I think we take it from that point. So, Ms. Majalamba, you would have noted how I summarized it now in terms of the writing that we will do. Thank you. Honourable members, I will now go to the last item of this morning, and it has to do with the request of a study tour to the UK. We are very thankful for all the work that has gone in from Ms. Majalamba and the team. And a lot of work to now. I've been appraised throughout, and we have been talking throughout about it. But unfortunately, due to the changing program of Parliament, we have not been approved for that particular date of the 25th of March. We could do one of two things. We can decide not to have the study tour, or number two, that we postpone the date of the study tour. And then if we, so number one, if we don't have the study tour, and number two, if we postpone the study tour, I am now proposing that we restart our work on the NHI bill in line with the rejection of our request for that study tour. So, honourable members, I'm opening now. I've seen the hand of Honourable Wilson. Honourable Gela, is that a legacy act? Because I saw it stayed up. And then Honourable Van Staden and anyone else, please raise your hands on the platform. So I see Wilson, Van Staden, Clark in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, look, I was the one who originally raised the need to go and do the study tour. And we were constantly being compared, particularly with Britain, our NHI and the situation in Britain's, with Britain's NHS. And I felt it was very important that we go and discuss in Britain how they started, how it unfolded, what kind of, things they started with, what, you know, how it unfolded, because we keep getting compared to that and we keep being told that that's how they did it. So I still believe this tour is very, very necessary. I've done a lot of studies on this because we were going on the tour. So I don't think we will make it in this time before we go into recess. But I do believe we definitely need to look at a date after the recess. I think the study tour is very important. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Van Staden. Honourable Wilson, sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to agree. I don't think we must, while the tour is declined by the Parliament, we must completely throw this study tour away. I think we must just postpone it to a later date, probably when we came back from recess. We can submit our request to Parliament again. I just don't think we must throw it away. I think we must still do this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Wilson. So, Honourable Wilson has posted on the chat group that we should ask Parliament for new. We must discuss new dates. And that we should not cancel this study tour. Honourable Members.
Chairperson, I did speak first. I think it was the Honourable Clark who had her hand up after me. Thank you.
Oh, sorry then. Honourable Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been covered by Honourable Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We also note the suggestions by members of the Portfolio Committee. Ms. Majalamba and I will have a discussion and we will revert to you. I'm not certain whether it will be the next meeting or the meeting after, but do not forget that I had also made a proposal that we start with the work that we had then delayed because of the study tour. So, honorable members, it will put an obligation on us to start with the work that we, and I will be in discussion with the committee secretary in order for us to initiate that process again. Honorable Fasanen, is that another hand?
Yeah, Chair, no, thank you. It's a new one. I just want to ask if we are looking into a new date, but we ask the committee clerk also to just get us some information if we're going to need some visas as members of parliament to go to Britain so that we can arrange that process also to kick off, if you understand what I'm saying. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I fully understand. Thank you, Honourable Van Staden. It was going to be raised in this meeting, but we had received the letter of the request being declined yesterday. So today we were going to ask everyone to please apply for your official passports. And from what I understand from the committee secretary, we will require visas in order to do the study tour. So you might as well initiate the process now. Those who have not applied yet for an official passport, please speak to the committee secretary. She will assist you in order for you to for that process to be sped up. And when the right moment comes, she'd also be able to assist everyone with the application of the visa. So, honourable members, we will be discussing this again. I thank you very much for your participation today in this meeting. I do not think there are any other matters which we need to discuss. So, therefore, this meeting is then adjourned.
Thank you, Chair. Have a good day.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Bye-bye.
Recording stopped.